Hey there, it's Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. The title of this interview is called Copywriting Legend Drayton Bird Wants to Know the Secrets Behind HardToFindSeminars.com. Look, if you're on my email list, then you know I send out a ton of email. And some of them have pretty crazy subject lines like Ever Smell Dead Crickets or The Boy Who Shaved His Brain. UK copywriting legend Drayton Bird says he doesn't open anyone's emails as much as he opens mine. What an honor. So he wanted to interview me to see how I run HardToFindSeminars.com. Yep, Drayton wants my secrets. So in this audio interview, you'll hear Drayton grill me on how I use email marketing and interviews to open up as many doors as possible. You'll hear where I come up with my email ideas and stories, how I tie them into marketing, exactly how I make money, how I find experts to interview, how I license products, and how it all started out of my one-bedroom apartment with a skincare product and some pens. You'll also hear Drayton as I compare notes on all kinds of insider knowledge about sales, direct marketing, and the keys to online success. One thing you'll hear us talk about is how I increased the dialogue with my list. I send out a lot of emails because I want that day-to-day exchange with my list. You never know where a response will lead, so my goal is to get as many responses as possible. Personal one-on-one emails that open doors. And in this interview, you'll hear a detailed look at the recent change I made to my email marketing that has brought my response rate up faster and more effectively than anything else I've ever tried. It even seems to be working on the voyeurs. You'll also hear how my website got its name, why and how I started doing marketing interviews, and how I keep it growing. You'll hear the magic that happens in the editing room, how long it takes, and how much I pay someone to do it for me. You'll hear my no-brainer way to respond to 300 emails per day, personally, without it taking over my life. You'll hear how I get experts to spill their secrets in interviews, and a quick story about how Vic Conant from Nightingale Conant, $50 million a year company, once shared one of the most insider secrets from his multi-million dollar company with me. You'll hear how many emails I send out and why fear of sending too many is costing you money. You'll see the scary side of MLM that both Drayton and I agree on that you should know before you even consider getting involved with one. You'll learn real-life examples of how I keep my antenna up for story ideas to use in my email promotions and a quick no-holds-barred dissection of three of my most successful promotions. You'll hear how to find turnkey products to license for pennies. You'll hear about a little-known fact that you have to be interested in other people in order to be successful. So give, 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 but don't forget to sell. Here's how. You'll hear secrets to making passive income. I earn money while I sleep, and you can too. You'll hear about Drayton's big secret. He laughs, but there's a lot of truth in what he's saying. I have an incredible amount of free time because I've built the perfect business. My interviews do my selling 24/7. I outsource all the work, and my products have incredible margins. But my biggest achievement is that my sons are growing up with a dad who's around. And in this audio interview, you'll hear the secrets I use to keep the good times rolling. Now let's get going. Hi, I'm Michael Senoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive.
Today I really wanted to talk to you, Michael, because you are unique. I would think that there is nobody who sends me emails whom I read more than I read you. With the exception of people like Mr. King, who used to do interviews on television, you must have done more interviews than anyone I can think of. And there are a number of other things that interest me, and I think would interest anybody listening to this, about what you do. Because it's all very well to do interviews. That alone is a challenge. to find interesting people to interview, that's a second challenge. But the third challenge, and perhaps the most important one to me, is how do you get people to listen to the interviews? And you do it with consummate skill. How the heck do you do it?
Thanks for the introduction. I appreciate that. And I'm honored that you open and read my emails. I can remember the very first response that I received from you. It was an email I sent out with the headline about the pistol shrimp, a little shrimp that has the incredible power in its little claws. And I was honored that, hey, Drayton Bird actually responded to one of my emails. And this has been 6-7 years ago. And since then, we've had multiple email exchanges. And so I'm honored that you respond to my stuff. It's really an ego booster. I appreciate it. It all started when I was here in San Diego, and I was living in this one-bedroom apartment down in Pacific Beach in San Diego, California. I was broke. I had a $3,500 phone bill when long-distance phone calls were expensive. I was trying to market and hustle some skincare product that I'd learned about in the multi-level industry, and I knew I needed a product that I can control and something I can hustle on my own, whether it was door-to-door or through the phone. And I had gotten into the pen business. I had seen this pen that could detect counterfeit money. You take this pen, you swipe it across a U.S. dollar bill, and if the mark turned yellow, it meant it was a genuine bill. If the mark turned black, it was a counterfeit bill. And I thought if I could figure out how to make this damn thing, I could just go to anywhere and sell these things for $5 or $10 or $20. I ultimately figured out how to make these pens, and I started selling them. And then, like anyone who has a business, I was in need of understanding and learning the important concepts of marketing. I had always been a student of personal development. I had studied Zig Ziglar in sales, Brian Tracy, the psychology of closing the sales. I was already somewhat of a learner, but I didn't have my bearings down on what marketing is. And when I did research, I came across Mr. Jay Abraham, and I had found something on the early days of the internet, and I ended up calling his offices, and I ended up buying for about $225. It was a set of four videos called My Life in Marketing. It was Jay Abraham's whole story about marketing. And in addition, I also got a video which was his concept of business optimization. And when I watched that stuff, the light went on. I knew I had found the key to what I was looking for. Keys that went beyond secrets of closing the sale. It was the marketing, because the marketing was everything. It's how to get the message out and specifically how to do it. I had no money, and I wanted to get a hold of his $15,000 seminar. And I ended up doing some networking. I found the guy who had gone to one of these $15,000 seminars, and I begged him to send me a fax of the people who attended the seminar in California. And I got the names and the phone numbers of the people who paid $15,000 and later $20,000 to attend Jay Abraham's 4- and 5-day events. Got on the phone and I found someone in San Diego who had all the tapes, all the books, all the manuals that they had paid $15,000 for in perfect condition, and I was able to buy those for $50.
$50.
So I got everything for $50, and I started devouring the material and learning it and studying it and filling my mind with all these concepts of marketing. About a year later, I was engaged, and I wanted to buy a big blue barbecue grill. It was called a Kamado. And it goes back to Japanese cooking where they cooked with coals in the ground. And you've probably seen the green egg. It's a smoker, and additionally it's a cooker that you cook with propane. And it was a very expensive grill. It was about $1,700. My fiance at the time did not want me spending the money on that. And I said, well, I'm going to sell my Jay Abraham tapes, and I'm going to put them up on eBay. And at the time, eBay was kicking butt. Digital cameras had just come out. I had just purchased a Sony Mavica digital camera. It was about a $1,000 camera, and this was a camera you could slide a hard disk, the little square disk, into the camera. You could take the picture, and it would transfer the digital image onto this disk. And I wanted to start selling stuff on eBay, so I put that set of J. Abraham material that I paid $50 up onto eBay, my first auction, and I sold it for $1,700 to a guy named Piero in Australia. I think he's still on my list 15 years later. And then I just did it over and over and over again. I ended up getting the list of all 900 people who went to the J. Abraham seminar, and I sat on the phone calling them up one by one saying, I know this is a weird call, but hey, by any chance you still got that J. Abraham stuff sitting around? Because most people would go to the seminar, they'd come home, and they'd put the stuff in a box in the garage, and they would never use it.
This is so true. So, essentially, you got involved in this, or the beginnings of this, not because, yes, you wanted to make money. The first thing you wanted to do was to learn marketing. And one other question, you were essentially a salesman. Do you think it's easy or difficult for salesmen to break into marketing?
I don't think it's easy, but if the salesman learns how to automate his selling skill, the real key is the leverage of having these sales messages disguised as interviews selling for me 24/7, whether it's selling a physical product or a digital product that you can buy on my website, or selling the listener on my credibility, or selling them on my friendship. It's all about building that relationship, and interviews can do all of that.
I'm obviously in the marketing business, and I get lots and lots of emails, most of which I ignore, and I get lots and lots of emails from people who are trying to sell things or promote things, most of which I ignore, because I think that the art of this sort of thing, like any other art, is played by a vast majority of people who don't have any idea what they're doing, and a small minority, a very small minority, who do know what they're doing. And to me, you stand out in that small minority.
So with all that J. Abraham stuff, I started buying and reselling this stuff on eBay, and that is why I named my website hardtofindseminars.com. In its origination, it was just a one-page sales letter that talked about how I had all these very expensive retail marketing seminars for pennies on the dollar.
Do you have a copy of that sales letter?
I do. It's actually on the Wayback Machine. So if you search the Internet Wayback Machine, you can search websites going all the way back 15, 20 years. You can see what websites looked like from their origination. So anyone could go to the Wayback Machine, type in Hard to Find Seminars, and find that original letter. I remember I had no idea how to even put up a letter. I had no clue. I had hired and paid a coach to help me get that letter up, and then he disappeared, and then ultimately I just had to learn to do all this stuff on my own.
Do you know what's really interesting? When you said, I know this is a weird question or a weird call or whatever it is, it's actually very close to a very, very successful headline that people keep on running in various ways, which actually goes back to the 1920s, when I think John Cagle first used the line weird, there's a weird trick or something like that. Still used today. That's the other thing that interests me. The thing that worked 70, 80, 90 years ago still works today. Anyhow, carry on. That was really interesting.
Selling all of these Abraham seminars, I couldn't go counterfeit the stuff. I could only sell what I had. And I soon began to realize that I was running out of people to call on and running out of my availability on used J. Abraham material. Well, I had to get people to the site to buy the J. Abraham stuff, and I just learned how to record a phone call with some online software called ModemSpy, where I could record a digital conversation. I was just learning about MP3 files, and then I would talk marketing to people, and I would ask if I could just record the call, and that's how it all started. So the whole reason the interviews started, I would add them to my hard-to-find seminars website to give people more of a reason to come to the site and hope and pray that they would buy my pre-owned J. Abraham seminar material. But when that stuff ran out, I knew that I needed to have control since I had these people coming to the site. My interview inventory was building up, and I had to have something that I had of my own to sell, and I started developing and publishing my own information product. Everything was all about getting traffic to the website to either buy my Abraham material, using the interviews as the bait to get people to come to the website, offer some good free value with some good interviews, and then, oh, by the way, I would capture an email address and a name and be able to market to these visitors and subscribers to my website.
So what happened next?
I wanted to learn how to market my counterfeit money detector pens and my invisible ink marking pens and my vanishing ink pens and my spot remover pens, and I kept studying marketing, and I needed to build more of a library of interviews. And I will say that the interviews really ultimately were to build traffic to the site, but primarily I would interview people about stuff that I was interested in. And then the traffic just started building and the relationships just started building, and I didn't see anyone else out there who was just crazy enough to try and take on what I was doing, because it's a lot of time and it's a lot of money, and I've just built up a little bit of a following over the years, and that's where I am today.
Did you ever end up selling your pens?
Absolutely. The marketing I learned helped me a great deal in selling the pens, and I used that marketing information to sell them, and I still have accounts that I generated that order from me consistently. And the pen business is not a huge business. I put no focus and time in it. But even back then, 18 years ago, I generated accounts that I still service and generate income from today.
How many interviews have you actually done?
I probably haven't done as many as you think. I've probably done 300 to 400 interviews. And most of them are published, but not all of them are available on my site for free. What I've done recently in the last 4 or 5 years, because it is very expensive doing an interview, you have a lot involved. I know it sounds easy. We're talking on the phone together. I have my digital recorder recording the conversation. After that, the process would be I would send this to my editor and we would edit. One thing about my interviews that I personally believe makes them stand out from any interview in the world is the flow and the easy listenability of my interviews. And the reason that is I edit them meticulously. Most people speak very poorly. And I have edited hundreds of hours of interviews where I am editing out ums and ahs and you knows and rights and double talks and stammers and changes of topics in these interviews. People's language today is littered with these pauses and these misthoughts and these filler words. On an average of an hour interview, depending on my guest, we may spend 5 hours just doing the editing on one interview. It's almost like a feature film that hits Hollywood. They have hundreds of hours of tape, and then it goes to the editing room for months. All the magic happens in the editing. So when you clean up an interview and you eliminate all those words, and a listener's listening to the interview, it just goes in easy. When you listen to an interview that's littered with ums and ahs and ands and stammers, it's hard to listen to. People don't want to listen to it. They may push the stop button or they may hit the delete button. My goal in producing a final interview is to produce the most pristine product I can in the editing. That's one aspect about my interviews that I think is really important. Now, over the last 4 or 5 years, I've done a lot of licensing. And because it's so expensive in the editing, and then having those interviews transcribed, having a writer go through the edited interview and write a nice headline and a good detailed description of exactly what's in the interview, I may have $150 to $200 in each interview. So it is an investment. I am investing in an interview, which, like I said before, is a sales piece disguised in an interview. But because of that expense, I've kind of gotten smart, and I've now bought collections of interviews where I'll find a good interviewer who has a good collection of interviews with names that are pretty well known. And we'll talk a little bit more about why it's important to get an interview with some marquee value, a good name. And I'll pay $25 for the rights. They're not even exclusive rights to a collection of interviews. And if they're on interesting topics related to marketing and it fits my market, I'll own those rights and then I'll do additional editing and I'll rewrite the description. I do have my voice on there because I'll usually read the introductions to the interviews that I've purchased, the licensing rights. I purchased some rights to some interviews from a very good interviewer named Chris Costello. She's interviewed some of the best health experts here in the United States. And at the beginning of the interview, she says, "Hi, this is Chris Costello interviewing for Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. She almost sounds like one of the roving reporters of CNN. You know, CNN runs a news story and you have the reporter reporting for CNN off location. So they seem like my interviews, but I've licensed them and I've just improved them and made them better. But between the interviews I've done, probably 300 or 400, I've got another 100 to 150 or 200 licensed interviews. And some are given away for free. Some are used for content and product creation. Essentially, those are the two main reasons. I either sell them or I use them and give them away for free.
So for which types of interview, which ones got the biggest response?
Well, that's a good question. I'll tell you, one of the best interviews that I did that got the biggest response, of course, Drayton, was the interview we did. If any of the listeners just go to Google and type in these three keywords, Drayton Bird interview, it should come up number one. It's been a very popular interview, and I think it's because we did 10 of your most intriguing stories from your career. And I just got to sit there and listen to you recount all the most amazing stories about your marketing and advertising days. That's what people love. They don't want to be taught to. They want to hear interesting stories. Drayton, you're known in the copywriting circle. So my copywriting interviews are very popular. The copywriters like Gary Halbert and John Carlton and Ben Settle and Ted Nicholas, Brian Keith Voiles, Bob Blott. But if I put an interview up, it's not just going to become popular. It depends how I promote it. And you know that I promote my interviews through my emails. One interview I just sent out last week, the title was called The Boy Who Shaved His Brain.
I saw that.
Let me tell you the story. When I typed that, I meant to put The Boy Who Saved His Brain. And it was actually a typo, which I caught before I sent it out. And I said, you know what? This sounds pretty interesting. I'm going to leave it. And because I now make people respond to me personally if they want the link to the interview, on the fly, I can gauge the response of a headline in an email. That one email got a huge response. It was all about high-intensity brain training with a gentleman I had met 3 years ago named Michael J. Lavery.
Things that do very well are things that not only imply a story, and that's what's great about yours. Nearly every one of your emails is a story. And the other thing is it's something which actually you almost have a physical response. When you read that line, it makes you feel a little bit uncomfortable.
I want that person to feel a little uncomfortable. I remember when I got an email from Gary Halbert. Gary Halbert was on a list of mine from a site called hardtofindads.com. And I had put an email out, something about Jay Abraham, and I remember the email coming in from nosexgary@aol.com. And he said in the email, I'll never forget it, he said, Jay Abraham doesn't have a creative bone in his body.
I tend to agree with him.
He, in my eyes, was a marketing idol and a marketing god. I was nervous to respond to him. But once you get someone who maybe is nervous to respond to one of my emails, even if all they have to do is type in the subject line, send interview, I start that relationship right there. Everyone's list has mostly voyeurs, people who just look at the stuff but never have to do anything to respond. Now, I want to step up my list's game. I want them to physically respond. And when they do, they will be pleasantly surprised that I will personally reply back to them. And I will make it personal. I want to build more of a personal relationship through this great medium of email, but they have to step up and respond. And when they do that, I have the opportunity to start building that relationship.
Very interesting, because I guess I belong to a lot of forums and this, that, and the other, and I get into a lot of arguments, and there's a lot of talk now about content marketing, which always makes me laugh, because as far as I'm aware, all marketers always have content. And of course, somebody started an institute, because the first thing that people do when something becomes fashionable is start an institute and make themselves sound respectable. And apparently, according to the Content Marketing Institute, content marketing is sort of content. It's stuff that you send out to people that's helpful, but you don't ask them to reply. But as far as I'm concerned, that is like going from here to New York, flying from here to New York, and staying at JFK, not going into the 50s. You're missing out the most important part, which is to get people to respond. I was quite John Cagle's, he said, well, 50, 60, 70 years ago, and people have read your copy, they want to know what to do. Tell them.
What I'm doing may be totally wrong, but I've chosen to give this a try. If I can have a more concentrated, responsive list, I mean, I know who the serious subscribers are, and it's those people who respond. But it may take 4, 5, 6 interviews to get that person who's never responded to get them to respond. And once he responds, he stepped over the line and he says, okay, now it's okay for us to maybe have a correspondence. At least I get the ball rolling in that manner.
Very, very interesting, because this is exactly what I think. I'm trying to build a relationship. The relationship starts, if we're having a conversation with somebody, and you say something to somebody and they don't reply, that is not a conversation. You cannot have a relationship if you're just talking at somebody. You have to get them to reply. And then you have to get them to, please God, to commit to something, however small. Send off to something. And then you have to get them to buy something, however little. I'm constantly struck by how stupid I am, actually. I know this, but it took me quite some time. And you're quite right. Most people are just sitting there. They're not really interested. They're passive. You want the people who are prepared to do something, and those are the ones you've got to concentrate on.
This is where the interviews do a lot of heavy lifting. So if you can get them to respond, and they say, hey, I'd like to hear that interview, and you send them that interview, and they've actually had to create some energy in getting the interview, they're going to be more apt to listen to that interview. Now, the interview does the heavy lifting, because now they're listening to you for 30 to 45 minutes to an hour. You've got them captive, and you're able to sell them through an automated tool, and you do the interview once, so that automated tool is doing the selling for you without your personal time. The only personal time you did was reply back and send them the link to the interview that they asked for. So the interviews are your little salesmen. They're Michael Sinoff duplicated thousands of times. Anytime, 24/7, anywhere in the world, as long as they can understand the language. And that's where the real leverage comes in with these interviews.
You didn't tell me what surprised you most about the whole process.
What surprised me most is when I get emails from people who tell me they've listened to everything on my site. And it surprised me that how consumable audio interviews are. With technology today, the iPhones and the Galaxy and the smartphones, it is easier than ever to deliver an audio interview. And it's 40 to 50% of people open their email on their smartphone. Another surprising thing is when I do the interviews, if you're willing to just ask the questions and shut up, you'll be amazed at what people are willing to share with you. They will share all their secrets with you, because you may have an expert on a subject who's just passionate. He's spent his whole entire life doing that one thing, and his wife won't even listen to him. His friends won't listen to him. But when you schedule an interview and you're willing to ask those questions and just be willing to listen, he'll tell you everything you want to know. Another thing that surprised me is the stories I get from people. I had one gentleman named Robert Smith who I'd interviewed 10 years ago. He was a PR expert, and he sent me a short email. He said, Mike, I want to let you know that I just signed my first $1 million client in the PR business. It wouldn't have been possible without your interviews. I know the interviews change lives, but Drayton, you can bet when I got that email, what do you think I did? The first thing I did is I emailed him back. I go, Robert, that's incredible. Can I get an interview? So he gave me a beautiful interview on how he did it, from being on welfare all the way up to his first $1 million client. I got it all out of them, and it's an incredible interview that I have up on my site. I'm always surprised at how much people are willing to share.
Well, you've obviously acquired lots of great, helpful business ideas from doing these interviews. So which do you think gave you the most useful business ideas, Michael?
When I do these interviews, I'm really doing them for me. I want to interview someone that I can learn stuff from personally. I'd rather do that than interview someone on a subject that I have no interest in. All of the interviews have something to teach. All of them have failures. All of them have success stories. I hired an actor to play the part of Eugene Schwartz, and that interview was phenomenally interesting.
This is a recreation of the speech you made at Rodale, which I've got a copy of. I actually showed it in one of my own seminars here.
That's correct.
My interviews that I've done with my brain training guy, Michael Lavery, high-intensity brain training, is fascinating to me. The interview I did with Tom Hopkins is like a classic. Walt Disney, they have Disney classics, and Disney will keep some of their classic movies in the vault, and as the kids get older, every 3 or 4 years, they'll pull them back out. This is how I kind of look at some of my products and some of my interviews. Some of these interviews are timeless, and they're classic, especially the one with Tom Hopkins on selling. Cold calling is a very popular thing, and that's something I needed to get good in. So I interviewed multiple cold calling experts. That was fascinating. I even have an interview with Brian Tracy, Robert Kiyosaki, Bill Bartman, who became a billionaire. That was kind of interesting to see how a guy earned $1 billion through his business. The stuff on sales scripting, which I wanted to get down. The copywriting interviews, along with David Garfinkel, which was excellent.
He's a very funny man.
He is funny. Nightingale Conant. I interviewed Vic Conant, the son of the founder of Nightingale Conant. Yeah. He even shared with me on that interview his very top-selling categories of all of his marketing. He told me the number one seller at that time when I interviewed him was a product called How to Get Out of Debt by John Kamuda. How to Get Out of Debt was the top-selling tape series out of their entire library of hundreds of topics.
So it's one of these things where when somebody tells you that, you say, of course.
Well, I mean, he's sharing a piece of real valuable intelligence. I mean, he's sharing intelligence in his multi-million-dollar company of what his number one selling product is. Anyone with some marketing sense may want to create a get-out-of-debt product because it's telling of the demand in the marketplace. People will pay for information on how to get out of debt. There's a huge demand and a huge market.
Exactly.
Yeah, I have so many topics on the site, from marketing consulting to my expert on how to buy a business, Art Hamill, Jack Canfield. Incidentally, if someone was going to get into doing interviews, you want to go after big names. Drayton Bird's a pretty big name in the copywriting and advertising and marketing circles. And that name of anyone who has some success within their expertise is going to really help drive listeners to come to your interviews. Really, it's not about me at all. It's really the name of the expert, the marquee value. I did a lot of interviews in the beginning of people who had no names, which was interesting because I didn't have the confidence to go after the larger names. But if anyone was going to start doing interviews, I would tell them, the most important thing is go after a big player. Go after a good name because that credibility and that name is going to drive the listenership of your interviews. And if that drives the listenerships of your interviews, it's going to drive your subscriber rates. And the whole idea, remember we talked about, is getting a subscriber so you can build that relationship with them and ultimately be able to sell them some valuable products so you can earn an income. I mean, after all, I'm operating a business here. This is what I do full time. It's not a part-time endeavor. I have to make money to provide for my family.
What are the chief problems you have when doing interviews?
I'll tell you, Drayton, it's almost a perfect business. I don't have any employees. I have a virtual team. I'm an incorporated business. I'm the only employee. I'm the president, the vice president, the treasurer, and the secretary. So that is wonderful, not having to work with employees physically within the business. But I do have a team. At first, the problem was the sheer time it took to doing the editing. I was doing so much editing that I was developing wrist pain from clicking the mouse button so much, editing out all the crap words, the ums and the ahs in the interviews to clean them up. I have an incredible amount of free time to do anything I want. I don't have to screw around with employees because now I have a virtual team. Once the interview is done, I upload it. I send my wonderful editor and executive assistant, Diane, to do all the editing. She gets it up on the site. She'll send me a cleaned up version. Usually I'll go through it a second time. I have my writer writing the description. I automate all the bull out. And I would tell people, and I would tell you, anything you don't want to do, invest the money and outsource it. Because there's a lot of talented people who can do anything that you don't want to do. So I try and farm out all the stuff that I don't want to do and focus most of my time creating emails that generate interest in getting subscribers. I could spend all year doing additional interviews, but I have so many interviews I haven't even shared with my list. I think I've kind of gotten smart over the last year is to focus more on the marketing and just improving my website and building products that I can sell to my list. My lifestyle is pretty relaxing, and I joke with one of my best friends here. He tells me that my in-laws thinks I'm the biggest bum ever, and that my wife is the big bread earner of the family because I've been married for 15 years, and my wife's parents still have no freaking clue what I do.
Where do you get your ideas for emails? It's really awful.
I get my ideas from my kids. I get them from TV shows. I get them from my wife bitching at me. I get them from maybe getting a speeding ticket on the road. I get them from one Thanksgiving, my sister brought her dog to Thanksgiving dinner and how it caused a lot of problems because she couldn't bring the dog in the house and she sat outside and she was isolated from everyone else and it was a big pain in the ass. I talked about that. I get an idea from when my mother-in-law was yelling at me when we were having salmon one night and I took the fatty part of the fish from the tail rather than the meaty part from the front. I get the ideas from when we passed a blue swing on the side of the road and my wife wanted it and I didn't want to get it and I finally went back with the car and I couldn't fit it in the car and I tie it into a marketing lesson. I get it from when I had to paint all my wife's furniture from South Africa brown and how we used it in the kids' room. I get it from when my goldfish died or from when I bought our first gecko for my son, or when the neighborhood kid ran over my son's foot at the park. It comes from your day-to-day stuff.
Every single person listening to this is saying one thing to themselves. They're saying, how the hell do you get from your kid breaking his arm, or his foot being run over, or the dog being outside, how do you get from that to your interview?
How do I link up a story to a sales pitch? You build a bridge from your story and you tie it in to some subject of the interview. Doing a promotion on a product called USP Magic. My antenna is up for story ideas for the remaining 4 days of the promotion. It ends on Monday. I wrote an email that went out today. And I'll tell you specifically how I got this, and I'll tell you how I linked it. I've been taking a walk around the neighborhood after I have dinner with my son, Alan, my 11-year-old. But last night we finished dinner, and he goes, Dad, you want to go for a walk? And I said, sure. So it gives us a chance to talk, tell some jokes, sing some songs. He grabs a stick that was leaning against the wall. We had found it at the park the day before. It was a branch, and we used it as a walking stick. And then I wanted a walking stick, too, so I grabbed this ski pole that I had found from a garage sale. And as I'm telling it, this is exactly how I'm writing it as well. And so we get to the park, and there's a grassy area. I had to tie my shoe. And I jammed the ski pole, it's got a little point in it, into the grass. I didn't want to lay it down, so it stood straight up. And, you know, we were kind of joking with each other because he took my branch, my walking stick, and I got this ski pole, and I go, my stick does that. My radar in writing emails every day always has to be up. So, I think about it, I go, I think I'm going to use this story as one of my emails for my USB promotion. All I had at that point was that part of the story. When he took his walking stick and tried to jam it into the grass, it broke. I knew I was going to open up that email with that story, and I started writing it. So how do I make the connection from that story? I looked up the brand of the ski pole. It was called Scott. And then every product that you have has a story. And I went to the Scott website, and I started reading about how it started in the 1950s, and Ed Scott was an avid skier, and he was an engineer, and he ended up revolutionizing the ski pole industry. He became the leader in ski pole manufacturing, opened up one of the most sophisticated ski pole manufacturing plants in Italy. And it's all up on their website. They have a chronological history. And then it went on to tell how they created the lightest ski boot in the industry. Then they got into biking. They created the lightest carbon racing bike frame and the lightest road bike in the industry. And it became apparent that this company's USP was lightness. When materials are light, You go faster, and when you go faster, you win races. And athletes who are competing want to go faster because they want to win races. So I tied the physical object from a ski pole that I knew nothing about by learning its story, and then in the story, I related it to a USP. It was lightness. And I closed it out where I began. When I looked at Alan's broken stick from the park, and I look at my ski pole, I knew the difference. And then I tied it into my promotion. What makes you different? How are you unique? And then I pitched my USP product.
Now, you see, that is what I was looking for. And then you said something interesting that I can really relate. You said my antennae are always up. And that's the same with me. That's one thing we have in common. I never, ever stop looking. I've just got this automatic thing in me that spots things. I get the impression you don't email every day.
I'm not emailing every single day. I try and get at least 4 or 5 emails out per week. Because I'm responding individually, it does take up a lot of time. I was preparing to put together the USP Magic product over the last couple of days, so I laid off on interviews for the last 3 days because I had to get this done. And now I'm in a promotional mode promoting this USP Magic product. So I won't be doing story interviews. I'm just going to be doing stories related to unique selling propositions until Monday. But after Monday, I'll get back to my regular emails, whether it's sharing an interview that I've shared in the past or a new interview that I'm ready to publish for the first time. It could be different every day. It's just whatever I decide.
I think a lot of people are extraordinarily surprised to hear that anyone will be emailing practically every day, particularly the corporate people that I deal with from time to time. They think once a week is quite a stretch. And they're always terribly worried about people unsubscribing or not opening or not ticking through or whatever. What do you feel about that?
I think that they are leaving all the money on the table because of those fears. I think emailing every day has dramatically increased my financial gain. It's increased the magnification of my relationships with my readers. It's increased opportunities that have nothing to do with the interview. See, when you email every day, there's always some people on your list. You're reminding them of something. They may say, hey, Mike, I just listened to that interview on joint ventures. What do you think about this? Now that gives me an opportunity to respond to them and make them a special offer on my JV Magic product. You want the communications coming back and forth as much as possible, any kind of dialogue you can, whether it's a simple question, it's increased my consulting services. You want that day-to-day email because you never know what that response is going to lead to. And your goal is to get as many responses as possible, back and forth, personal, one-on-one emails. You want to open up as many doors as possible. For these corporations emailing once a month because they're worried about their people unsubscribing, that's ridiculous. You want to get those losers off your list as fast as possible. And that's a sure way to do it. Start emailing every day and all your dead wood will come off your list and you'll be left with your most responsive prime subscribers. Those are the people you want on your list and responding anyway.
I live in a part of Bristol called Clifton, which is very nice. There's a particular part of it, Clifton Village, which is extremely nice, very, very fashionable and smart. And as you can expect, in Clifton Village, there are lots of places that sell coffee. And 2 weeks ago, I went there with my partner, Marta, and we decided to go to a fish and chip shop, which is opposite a wine shop. And as we were going in there, I looked at the wine shop, and above the sign, there was a sign that just said, this is one of the very few establishments in Clifton which does not sell coffee. That made me smile. I took a photograph of it. And I think that this very, very strong belief that the normal process of argument that is used today by people selling things is highly predictable. Right? They try to make their claim stronger and stronger and stronger. And to some extent, less and less believable, in the hope of overcoming your resistance. They get you so greedy for what they've got that you're going to buy. But I think you shortcut all this, you cut through it, you eliminate all this. If you say one thing which engages an emotion like a smile, for I always refer to it broadly as charm, I think charm disarms resistance.
Now, you said something that sparked an idea, and we were talking about Larry King, and I did email you about the story when I met Larry King. It all has to do with the original Brooklyn Water Bagel Company, and these bagels really are incredible. And I was in L.A. visiting my sister, and we knew that this was the store Larry King had part ownership with, and he always sat there. And when we walked in, we were wondering, are we going to see Larry King sitting in his little booth? And sure enough, there he was. And my wife told me to go up and introduce yourself, and I was chicken. I didn't want to bother him. But I wanted to do it for my kids because my kids knew that I do interviews, and they also knew that Larry King was like the king of interviews. And so he walked out the door, and I almost missed out, and I ran after him. And I said, "Hey, Larry. Hey, Larry." And he turns around, and luckily he sees the kids. And I said, "The kids want to get your autograph." And he was nice enough to give them an autograph, and he chatted with us for a little bit. And he allowed me to take the picture. So I shared the picture with you and my two kids. Then I tied it into the USP. It's the water. They've been able to create and duplicate scientifically the same water found in Brooklyn, New York, that makes all the New York pizza and breads so delicious. And when I'm writing emails, your stories don't have to be always 100% true. You can use your creativity and you can mold the story to what you're trying to do. So when I said in this email, Larry turned to me and he was shaking his pen in my face after I told him, "Why are your bagels so good?" And he goes, "Kid, it's the water." And then I go into the water is the USP for this Brooklyn Bagel Company, which it is. So again, every place, every restaurant, every establishment has a story of how it began. And if it's popular, they're doing some special things. So it's not going to be hard to find something special that makes them unique from every other place out. So that's how you do it.
One of the secrets is unselfishness. And what I mean by that is, if you look at the kind of things that people do write about on Facebook, or you look at the pictures that they put up, a very high percentage of them are not very interesting. They're totally focused around themselves. And I think you've got to have the kind of mind which is unselfish to the point that you're going to be interested in other people and what will interest other people. That's why a lot of communications don't get read, don't get listened to, don't get watched. Because it's just a person talking about themselves. It's like the boring man in the bar who sits next to him and starts talking about himself. One has to be genuinely interested in other people. See, I think one has to be genuinely interested in other people if one wishes to be really successful in our kind of business.
You do. You have to give, give, give. I mean, I say you got to give till it hurts. You don't want to give everything away. You got to give, but you got to have the guts to sell, too. And you got to let your subscribers know you're in business to generate an income. You can be nice and give away a lot of good stuff, but when it's time to sell, you got to hustle and you got to have the courage to sell and be persistent. That's what I do.
You rather implied that for quite a long time you were simply communicating and you haven't really tried to make people reply. And you said that I've changed. I do try and make people reply now.
That is correct. For all these years, when I would send emails out, I would send the link to the interview. I would still have people who would reply because they would get the interview, but I now wanted to try and force more replies. I want to make people do a little bit more, make it a little harder, take it away from them a little bit. And I'm testing this right now. It's interesting because I've only done 2 days of this new promotion, and I have 35 different products that I've promoted over the last 5 years for $20, and some of them I've done multiple promotions for. And I've done about 56 promotions over the last 5 years where I create a good, valuable product and I sell it for $20. And I have all the stats on all 56 of my promotion, how many sales we got on each promotion, how many sales per day, how many emails went out, the average dollar made per email per day. I can get a good idea on what the final result of the promotion is just after the first email. And this is the first promotion I've done since I've made people reply, and it's extraordinarily high. Now, I can't be certain that it's because over the last 3 months, I've made people work a little bit harder to hear my interviews, or because I haven't included my links in my emails. It could be that, but it also could be the subject matter of USP, Unique Selling Proposition, that many people desire to learn more about that, or they understand it, and it's a more popular subject than some of the other things I've promoted. But in the back of my head, I'm thinking, could it be this abnormally high amount of sales on this specific $20 promotion on USP could have anything to do with me reducing the accessibility to my interviews over the last 3 months?
That's the trouble with this damn business. You can measure everything, but 9 times out of 10, there's more than one factor involved, and you never quite know what made the difference. I find this very frustrating. Now, I just think, as long as I'm making a decent living, what the hell?
Yeah, exactly. You don't have to make millions of dollars to be happy in this business. My goal in this business has always been to be able to have personal freedom, personal time to do what I want, to be here, be around for my kids where I'm not working some job, always away from the kids. My greatest achievement has probably been that the last 14 years, my oldest son is 14, I've been working, but I've been working at home. So I can say that, look, my kids grew up with a dad who's been around, and a lot of people can't say that. That's a big thing. And if this information product publishing business, using email to promote digital products, which is an incredible business. I can't think of any business better than what I'm doing right now, from the creative aspect to the money that you can make, from the time freedom you gain. I would encourage any of the listeners to investigate selling digital information products. It's an incredible, fascinating business and fun.
But don't you think that there's a startlingly large number of people who go into the business and are not really equipped for it, and they just don't know enough? I'm always astounded by the number of people who claim to be coaches, for instance, without ever having succeeded anything. I find this rather bizarre. What do you think?
I agree. You know, it's like in most professions, you know, it's the 80-20 rule, or maybe it's the 90-10 rule. Most people suck at what they do. There's only a few who are pretty good. The 10% who really know what they're doing, who are at the top of the game, it's a combination of genetics, it's a combination of desire and smarts and study and hard work and being willing to fail. It's a lot of factors that go into someone becoming successful.
Well, I always think that the greatest secret is desperation.
Desperation certainly helps. When someone's back is against the wall, you'd be surprised at what they can do.
I had a guy wrote to me yesterday from Australia, and he said, I've got lots of big ideas, he said, but I thought, I fancy to be able to get anything going. I said, I'll tell you something. The biggest single difference between people who succeed and people who fail is that people aren't talking about it. And I gave the example of the reason I'm in Bristol is because my partner was offered a job there. But we came together when she was working with me about 9 years ago. And on the same day, we had two meetings. And one meeting was with a very large corporation, General Electric, actually, GE Capital. And the other meeting was with a much smaller organisation called Hargreaves Lansdown, which deals with pensions. And we saw the people at GE, and nothing much happened. They kept on having meetings. They never actually did anything with what we'd done for them. But the guy at Hargreaves Lansdown was very interested, and we started working for him. And 6 months later, they were our biggest client. And today, one of the founders, he just retired, he just sold 50% of his shares for £200 million, which is $300 million. And for the other partner, is worth £2 billion, or $3 billion. They've got a total staff of 700. I worked out he's worth 10 times as much as Mick Jagger, something that people can relate to. And what's the difference between them and these other people who sit around having meetings? They get on with it, and they do what they want to do. And it's very funny that when eventually my partner was hired by the guy who hired her, he told me afterwards, he said, the very first time that he met her, that day that we went into his offices, half a mile away from here, and he wanted to hire her. And he kept on thinking, I'm going to hire her, I'm going to hire her. And she rang up, actually, to get the testimonial, because she got an interview at my old agency, Ogilvy One. And he said, why do you want a testimonial? And she said, well, I've got this interview at Ogilvy One. And if Drayton gives me a testimonial, they'll know that I work with him and they won't be less impressed. So, well, she can give me one. So this guy said, and this guy himself is actually worth quite a few million. He said, come and work for us. Instantly. He said, come and work for us. He said, I will have an offer for you by 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. And this was at 5 o'clock at night. And by 10 o'clock the next morning, he'd spoken to the chairman, a Navy officer, and so we had to move to Bristol.
Wow.
He knew what he wanted. And he could see the most valuable commodity in the world, apart from a good idea, is the right people.
You're right. The right person for the job you need is invaluable. I originally found a lot of my workers using Elance. And I would post a job. And when you have someone who does a good job for you, there's no reason to get rid of them. And Diane, my assistant, I've had her for over 10 years. The girl who writes a lot of my descriptions for my interviews, I've been working with her for 8 years. Once you find someone good, there's no reason to let them go. And if you can build that right team, it's easy.
And also, these jobs that other people think are simple, boring jobs, they require something which is incredibly valuable, and it's called reliability. I've got a guy that works for me called Anthony, and he does all the IT stuff, you know. I remember I ran an article on an internet thing and said, I'm looking for so-and-so. A guy I knew who was an expert on subscription strategy sent me an email. He said, why don't you hire my very bright young son? So I took him on. He works for himself, but he's terrific. I can send him an email now, and he'll be back to me. He'll either done it or explained that he can't do it right now. Usually he's done it within 10 minutes. But I've got other people like that, I agree with you. And I don't understand technology at all. I always say that I'm so excited about the discovery of the fountain.
It's not that hard. You should try and learn a little bit of it. I know enough to know what's going on. I think it is important, if someone does have an online business, to know how to do a website. First of all, but the technology is surprisingly interesting. What most people think they can't do, if they just take a little time to learn it, I think it's important if you're running an online business to have some idea of what's going on. It's a good investment, because once you know how to do it, you don't have to rely on Anthony. You can go in there and create a blog post and do an email.
I do a blog post myself. I only call in when I've got a problem. So, yeah, I write to a few blogs a day, and I always write my own emails. The times when I find it quicker, for instance, sometimes if I want to embed a picture in my blog or something like that, and it's coming from somewhere else, it's quicker for me to go to Anthony than to do it myself. I prefer to think about all the other things I'm trying to think about. What I should be thinking about is retirement, but I have no intention of retiring. I was going to say, what other subjects have we have to cover?
We were talking about the frequency in which people mail. I had said that most people are not mailing near enough and that they're leaving all the money on the table. And I was just basing that on my experience. In sales, there's a saying that the yes comes after the seventh no. I found that to be specifically true in my little promotions that I've been doing for the last 5 years. Imagine having a relationship with a girlfriend or a wife where you only talk to them once a month. That's not going to work. And we talked about that. This is all about building a relationship with the real person on the other end of that screen. I know it's a computer and it's a digital email, but there really is a real person sitting there on the other side of your screen receiving your message. And one email per month, you're going to be out of sight, out of mind. You're not going to have a real good chance of building a relationship. I had mentioned I've sold a lot of stuff. I mentioned I've published over 35 different products, and I've done these promotions for the last 5 years. I'll do a promotion that could last anywhere from 3 to 6 days. And I will tell you this, looking at the numbers, without fail, the first couple days of the promotion is usually one email a day. But the last day of the promotion, it could be up to 5 different emails. And we use a countdown sequence, and we sell the fear of loss. So we may have 18 hours before this promotion runs out, 7 hours left, 5 hours left. And I use different headlines to get the message across that you're going to lose out if you don't hustle. And without fail, that last day of the promotion, and in some instances, the last couple hours of the promotion will outproduce more sales than the entire previous days of the entire promotion.
Oh, really?
And so there's a lesson in that. The fear of loss is greater than the desire from gain. People are normally procrastinators, and they don't want to miss out. And if you remind them that they're going to miss out if they don't hustle up, that's when I find most of the sales come in. And I remember when I interviewed J. Conrad Levinson, one of my very first interviews years ago, he used to talk about the commitment to an advertising promotion, to make a decision and to commit. And I never really understood what that meant. But there's been many times when I do the promotion and there'll be only a few sales from that first email. And I say to myself, this thing is not going good. It's just not going good. But I persist and I stick with it and I end up doing the promotion. And by the end, without fail, it always ends up being a successful promotion. And those numbers always hold true in the last couple of hours and the last day of the email. So people who fear that their promotion is going to fail even after the first email, email more and commit to the promotion and stick to it. And in many cases, you'll see the results that you're hoping for. And so I understood what he meant about committing to an advertising promotion. You got to just stick with it.
I think I'm not as systematic as you are. Some of my promotions, I've done exactly what you said. I've done this 5 hours to go, 4 hours to go, three, four, or five emails in the last day. And they have worked. And I'm an idiot because I haven't always done it. And also, some of the people who work with me have said, oh, no, you can't do that. But I agree with you. I found that, with the exception of two things, where nobody showed any interest, and I thought, well, this is a waste of time going ahead with this, but all the other ones I've done okay. One of the things I do, actually, I do a thing every year in London, which lasts for 3 days. And I start promoting for it. This year is in October, so I started promoting this year's, at the end of last year's promotion, at the middle of October last year. I offered a big discount for people who would book in advance. And I've only got 40 seats to fill. I've already sold 20 of them. Because I've been promoting something else, you know, because I'm always promoting a couple of things. I'm either promoting something actually at the time. I'm usually promoting my creative services. So 2 or 3 days I'll be promoting one thing. And then the other 2 or 3 days I'll be promoting another, the book I wrote, Common Sense Straight Marketing. I said that men fear to lose as much as they hope to gain. And then it wasn't until some time later that I discovered that was not true. And in fact, it was that fear of loss is a greater incentive than hope of gain. That was one of the big discoveries for me.
I believe that's true.
It surprised me, didn't it? Because you think it would be more important for people to want something. You'd think, you know, they have to want something in order to be worried about losing it. So surely making them want it must be more important.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. They do want something. They want to not lose it. That's what they want.
Yeah. I always laughed when I used to read people said, I run my business from my garage. And I went, is it true? Is it true?
It absolutely is true. I'm sitting in my home, and I'm sitting in my garage. But my garage, it has a garage door, but the room has been converted. So there's walls in the room, and there's a door, and there's air conditioning, and there's lights and everything. So it's a modern garage, but I really am in my garage. There's carpet on the floor. Well, I haven't always worked out of this garage. There's been times over the years where it was just too much to do the interviews at home when the kids were younger, and I've had an office outside of my home. In one stretch, it was about 3 years, and then another time, about another year and a half. I'm currently working from home now, so I don't have any kind of outside office. But yeah, I'm in my garage right now. I've got a desk. I've got my computer. So I do run my business right out of my garage. Absolutely true.
What's interesting is that some people say to me, oh, I lack the self-discipline to be able to work at home. I would be busy trying to do something else. That's never troubled me. I don't know. Do you think it's something to do with the way people's minds work?
It's never troubled me because I've always been somewhat of a serial entrepreneur. I think there's a certain person who can't do it. Not everyone can do what we do, and it does take discipline. And I've heard that same response. Some people just don't have the discipline, but they don't know what to do. They don't know how to be an entrepreneur or what to sell. Maybe if they knew what they were going to do and their back was against the wall, and if you don't do what you need to do, your mortgage isn't going to get paid, maybe they would do it. I do have a choice. I can go get a job, but doing this is a much better decision than getting a job.
If somebody came to you and said, I want to set up on my own, what advice would you give them?
To sell something. There's no other business in the world that can generate you more income than selling something. I would tell them also to sell something that they control. You asked me what I thought about multi-level marketing, and when I did that, it was great, But the thing is, you were only making a tiny percentage of what you sold, and you had absolutely no control if the company was going to be around a year later. So all that effort and energy you put into building an organization under you was just taken away from you. And the same thing with someone who has a job, who works for a company, and they work them to death, and they've generated tens of millions of dollars in corporate sales for this company, and then they get canned the next year. All of that's gone. They could be putting that same amount of energy into a product that they own and control and that no one can take away from them. So controlling your own product, selling something, and selling something with huge margins. And digital information publishing has the highest margins of any product I can think of. You do the work once and you get paid ongoing. Those are three things I would tell people to do. Sell something you control, and sell something with huge margins. And digital information products, in my opinion, is the best business in the world.
What if you're not familiar with digital information products? If you're just a guy out there and working for these people, what should I do?
You certainly don't have to sell digital information products. You can sell physical products with lower margins. You're just not going to make as much, and you're going to work harder. If you want to sell something with huge margins and work less, and you don't know about digital information products, I would tell you to learn as much as you can about it. And I have a product, incidentally, that I've developed called Audio Marketing Secrets. Most of my product line, I am not the expert. I'm usually just the guy introducing you to the expert. For example, I introduce you and promote and sell you on Jim Camp, the world's number one negotiator, or Art Hamill, the expert who's bought over $250 million businesses, or I promote Claude Hopkins as the expert, or Rand Brenner as the licensing expert, or Ben Settle as the email expert, or Michael Lavery as the high-intensity brain training expert. But there's one product I have positioned myself as the expert, and it's called Audio Inner Juice Secrets. And it really is everything I know about how to create and do audio interviews, how to take those interviews and create digital information products, and how to sell them for high margins. So if someone did want to learn about how I do what I do, every aspect of it, I would tell them to go to Google, type in these three words, audio interview secrets, or audio marketing secrets on Google. It'll come up number one, and you'll have an introduction to a product where I position myself as the expert on how to do it.
Very good. It all goes back to the International Correspondence School in 1900. You're just training people to do things, and that's all you're doing. It's just a different medium with huge margins. And I always think that the big money is to be made where there is a mismatch between the cost of creating something and its perceived value. So in the old days, if you were selling a paper course, one of the most successful things I ever did was just help people sell a course on investing. The course cost an awful lot of money. But it didn't cost very much money to produce, did it? Typically, maybe it cost £5 to produce. But I think it sold for £120 at huge margin. Same sort of thing.
There may be people listening and saying, there's no way I'm ever going to take the time to do all these interviews, to do all the editing, and to create my own information product. I just don't have it in me. And there's an answer to that. And the answer is licensing. You can license complete products that are already done, that have been proven in the marketplace. Just go back 15 years and think about all the promotions you've seen online on marketing and advertising related products. What 99% of these publishers do is they promote it once with very little marketing effort. They get the money, and guess what they do with the product? They shelve it, and it's sitting in a folder on someone's hard drive. The sales letter that they've paid a copywriter between $5,000 and $10,000, maybe $20,000 to write is sitting there just waiting to be brought out into the market again. So one could go and find experts within an industry, contact them either by phone or email and say, hey, what do you got sitting on your computer that you promoted 5 or 10 years ago that was really successful? And you can license the rights to that product, and then you can enhance it and do a couple interviews that bring it relevant today, if it needs to be relevant. You can change the headline. You can dress it up. And you can republish that product. I told you I got 35 different products. Each one of those are like Disney classics sitting on my hard drive. I have a lot of people who come onto my list, and I have a lot of people who come off of my list. So I have a new crop of students on my list as time goes by, and I can relaunch that product and duplicate the success over and over and over again. You can use these promotions and these products as annuities. Whenever you need to create some new income for yourself, you just bring one out of the vault and you duplicate the promotion. You've got all the emails there. Everything will work exactly the same to a new market on your list.
There's a wonderful circularity about what you just said, because when we started talking, we talked about how you got involved. And how you got involved was by taking something that somebody else had sold for an immense amount of money. I think you said people were paying as much as $20,000. And you realised that, I think this is a great stroke of genius, in the sense that everybody knows this if they think about it, but people don't think about it. And what your great insight was that you thought, oh, these people are sitting there with this guy's product on their shelves. They probably never even looked at it. And I know this is true. People buy this stuff and they just put it away and they don't look at it. And the difference between success and failure to me, and this is what's really interesting, is it's not the question of whether you have a good product or service. The question is, are you selling it? And I live across a nice area. There are about 20 restaurants within, you know, 5 minutes walk of here. And I was writing about this the other day and pointing out that not one of them does any marketing. Not one. They are all at the mercy of trend, fashion, convenience, where they happen to be, whatever. The only one that has any, what I would call real marketing, has it almost by accident, because it's just a restaurant called the River Cottage Canteen, and the guy who started this chain is on television a lot. He's got public relations, he's got the best thing he can ever have, he's being seen on television as an authority. None of the others do anything. I don't care what business you're in, what field you're in, you will look around that field and you will see that most of the people in that field are not doing any proper marketing. And as you were saying, you can take something that's there and has been there and has been forgotten, that's been sold and shelved, and you can transform it. You refer to an annuity. That's a very, very good way of describing it. If I really want to close down my business today, I don't have to work. I've got a couple of things that just pay. They pay money, month in, month out. They're all made of stuff that I've learnt over the years. Couldn't agree with you more about that. Really, really clever.
Yeah, most people don't market also because they don't know what they stand for. All these restaurants, they're commodity. None of these owners have taken the time to really discover what makes them different, what makes them unique. Because they've never done that, the only thing they can compete on is what everyone else competes on, and that's price. And so it's so important. This USP Magic product that I'm putting out shows people how to develop their own USP, how to find their uniqueness, how to establish their differentiation from the marketplace. And if you can get that first, then you have something to say in your advertising. You have something to say in a postcard or a handwritten letter or on your TV commercial or on the sign when you walk into the business or on the on-hold phone recording when someone calls to order, or the waitress has something to say when they take the order from the patrons who visit the restaurant. You've got to know what makes you different and what makes you stand apart, and then you can start doing your marketing. I think this USP is very important for all businesses, and it's not just for a product or service. It's for people. What makes a person unique? You know, Diane, my assistant, she was helping me do the final editing on the product, and she had a thought and she wanted to share it with me, and she told me what makes her unique in a commodity world of a virtual assistant is she doesn't charge me for learning.
Wonderful. Wonderful. There's one thing I forgot to ask you.
What?
So you talked about your list. How do you get people onto your list?
That's a good question. How do I get people on my list? First of all, I've been very fortunate. I've been online for almost 18 years. I do have, finally, a great internet presence. So when I mention go to Google and type in Drayton Bird interview, I will come up number one. My blog will come up first. then my website will come up, and then your two videos come under me. So I have established over the years and over the time some good search engine optimization. It's grown organically over time. That's number one. I have about 1,000 to 1,500 unique visitors come to my site a day. And my hook is all my free content. Like I said, when I started selling those J. Abraham tapes, I needed something to get people to come to the site. Just like an anchor store in a mall, the huge Target that brings people into the mall, and then they have all the other small stores around it. My free interviews and the quality of my free content is what drives the traffic. And when someone comes onto any page of my website, a pop-up comes on, and it invites them to join my daily e-newsletter. And they can enter their email address and their first name. They're notified that they will be getting emails almost daily. And they come on as subscribers. And some stay on for a long time. Some get pissed off that I send too many emails, and they delete. Many people will share the interviews with their friends, so I'm sure I have a lot of referrals where people share my information with others, and then they come to the site and they get on. So it's an organic thing, but it all starts with the good quality interviews that I provide for free. I've had countless people tell me that my interviews are more valuable than a college education. It is a free university of business, marketing, advertising education on my site, just there for the taking.
Certainly true.
I'm honored. I really appreciate the chance of sharing some of my stories with your listeners. I hope I've brought them some value and maybe kicked their butt a little bit to try some new things. And I appreciate you having me on.
That's hugely, hugely interesting. I've learned a lot. Thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, you're welcome. That's the end of the interview where Drayton interviews me. I hope you've enjoyed it. And for more interviews like this, go to Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.